Welcome to the IDC podcast. The IDC promotes independent research on antitrust and competition law and policy issues, being also the point of contact between all those who have a special interest in the area, both in Latin America and globally.
Our speaker today is Spencer Waller. Spencer, apart from being an old good friend, he's from Chicago. He's a professor of the Loyola University in Chicago. He's also the director of the Institute for Consumer Antitrust Studies at the same university. And he's also a member of the IDC's International Advisory Board. He's author of various books and articles on antitrust issues and related issues. He will speak about, as we said, the political face of antitrust. And let me say he might be willing to talk about also the dark side of antitrust.
Pablo, thank you. Thanks to the IDC. Thanks for all of you to for taking the time to join me. I just took a quick look at the gallery view and I see the names of many friends. I'm sorry we all can't be together, but this is a great substitute given the circumstances. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. I really have about 20 or 25 minutes of remarks that I want to give, and I'm happy to take your questions when we're done. And this was something that really a paper that will be published in one of the journals of Brooklyn Law School, where I was supposed to have given this paper as part of a conference that got canceled toward the end of March. The paper and the presentation really have two parts. One is just to bring all of you up to date on the tremendous flourishing of antitrust as a political issue in our campaign year and beyond what politicians say and what they do. How it's become an important part of public discourse. Obviously not the only thing. Everything is completely swamped at the moment by discussions of Corona and the response. But in terms of just civil discourse, civil society, antitrust has a certain resonance in the United States and elsewhere that just hasn't been true in quite a long time. In addition, I do want to talk of what Pablo referred to as the dark side of antitrust, and I'll get to that toward the end, and that may be part of this paper that I published in Brooklyn. It may be part of a later, longer work, and we'll just see how that goes, and I really welcome your thoughts about what I call the dark side, but also what I really mean is, what if state agencies, public enforcers, do the right thing for the wrong reason? I'll save that for the end. So, in terms of the political face of antitrust, I also want to point out that one of my students has been very helpful and will be a co-author of this program, of this article. So, let me suggest to you that antitrust law has always been part of the political discussion in the United States, at least from the late 19th century on. As most of you know, the United States has had state antitrust laws since about 1880 and federal antitrust laws since 1890, both of which were the result of the economic turmoil in the wake of the Civil War, the industrialization and the nationalization of the U.S. economy. You can think of both national means of transportation from the railroads and national means of communications from telegraph and then telephones. And the disruptions that this economic tumult caused really resulted in political movements in rural and urban areas alike. And I think one of the highlights is just simply to note that there was an anti-monopoly party that ran candidates for president and unsuccessfully and local office successfully in the 1870s and 1880s. And so state antitrust law was the first response, and you really can't have state antitrust law to deal with a national economy. So eventually you had the enactment of the federal antitrust laws, a political issue, and remained an issue of great political salience all the way through the election of 1912. And there's a book called, cleverly enough, the Election of 1912 that discusses this in great length. There were four principal candidates. William Howard Taft was president. Theodore Roosevelt had been president, was succeeded by Taft, but didn't like what Taft was doing, so he ran as an independent third party. Woodrow Wilson was a Democratic candidate, and the fourth candidate was Eugene Debs, a socialist who spent most of his time in prison for violating injunctions relating to labor disputes. What's interesting about the election of 1912, and unlike any election between then and maybe now, is how much antitrust was an important part of the political discourse. The three major parties, not counting the gentleman who was the socialist, who really didn't think there was much of a role for a market economy, the presidential election largely turned on what to do about issues of concentration and abuse of corporate power, things that resonate today. William Howard Taft thought that the case method and the rule of reason were the way to regulate the economy through law, and he basically favored the status quo. Theodore Roosevelt sought more active regulatory agencies to separate the good trusts from the bad trusts. And Woodrow Wilson argued for a major legislative reform to overturn the Standard Oil decision, give more meaning to the rule of reason, create a new expert body that could regulate business in a friendly, non-adversarial way. And with, in essence, Taft and Roosevelt splitting a lot of the Republican vote, Wilson won, and the result was the Clayton Act, which gave greater specificity to the Sherman Act, as well as the creation of the Federal Trade Commission. From that time forward, I think there's been a political consensus that really reigned from about 1920 on through 1980. And I don't mean that it was always in favor of more antitrust or less antitrust. At least in the United States, there were both expansions and contractions in the vigorousness of antitrust enforcement that were largely bipartisan, depending on what era you're in. During the 1920s, there were diminutions of antitrust law. And in the first half of the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt really pursued a path of regulation rather than antitrust. And in the second half of the New Deal, he turned from the failed policies of the NRA, the National Recovery Act, and really began to enforce antitrust law through Thurman Arnold, who I've written about, as head of the antitrust division. And this consensus continued in the post-war era under both Democratic presidents like Truman and Kennedy and Republican presidents like Eisenhower. By the time in the 1970s, two things happened that kind of limited the role of the antitrust. One is there was a bipartisan movement to deregulate the economy that started under Carter and really had both Democratic and Republican champions for very different reasons. And then following the election of Ronald Reagan and the role of Justice Lewis Powell and then Scalia and the rise of the Chicago School that most of you are familiar with, there was a major contraction, particularly in how antitrust law was enforced by the Supreme Court on a case-by-case basis. As most of you know, categories of behavior that were per se unreasonable became subject to a case-by-case analysis. Conduct that was the basis for monopolization cases became lawful. And I guess back to the political side, antitrust largely disappeared from the campaign rhetoric and the party platforms beginning in the Reagan era. Up till that time, both parties pretty much said the same things and favored vigorous antitrust, and that disappeared on both sides of the aisle as an important campaign issue. And so, in addition, when the growth of antitrust outside of the United States, particularly in the EU, led to certain cases against American firms, both Republican and Democratic presidents in the US pushed back against that kind of activity. So the return of antitrust. Here you see an array of the Democratic candidates before the primary was largely settled, and Joe Biden has emerged as the presumptive Democratic nominee. I can't even identify all of these people for you, but at one time there were 20-some Democratic candidates. And antitrust, as I'll talk about, really became a campaign issue. And so there's three ways that I think antitrust is part of the public eye in a way that's just new and, in my view, very, very helpful. First, I'll talk about is candidate policies and promises, mostly are focused on merger reviews and revising merger guidelines. Number two, for those presidential candidates and others who are serving in the United States Congress, there have been a flurry of legislative proposals that I'm also happy to talk about, at least at a summary level, and then give you all a chance to ask any questions. And then I'm very encouraged by the fact that antitrust is not just a technocratic economic discourse, but is something that the media is beginning to cover, as well as books, and is just part of the general conversation. So as to the campaign promises, let me start with Joe Biden. What's interesting is, of all the candidates, obviously he has emerged as the presumptive nominee. However, he's had nothing specific. There are general calls for more enforcement of the antitrust laws. Now, I suspect he will focus on these issues in the campaign once we get past the first wave of corona crisis a little bit more, because I think he's going to be pushed by some of his prior challengers and now supporters, particularly Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, because they had talked about these issues in greater detail and also have been involved as senators with some legislation and draft legislation. The Sanders campaign focused on reviewing recent mergers and trying to undo consummated mergers. Sanders wanted bright line merger guidelines that set caps, usually by size and sometimes by market share, for vertical mergers, horizontal mergers, and total market share. And he also wanted to expand the role of the FTC and give them more powers that would be very familiar to people who work with the European Commission or agencies modeled after them. That would include some rulemaking authority and the ability to impose administrative fines, which don't exist in civil antitrust in the United States. And Elizabeth Warren, who is famous for having a plan for everything, had a plan for antitrust and competition that revolved around the concept of platform utilities. Think about Google and others, and the idea in her proposals that they had an obligation of fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory dealing with firms who were both customers and competitors. Her proposals also included reviewing and potentially unwinding anti-competitive mergers. Some of the lesser known candidates that if you're not in the United States or following the campaign closely, did have some interesting detailed proposals. Senator Klobuchar had some proposals relating to merger reform and the creation of an Office of Competition Advocate, like an ombudsman, to sort of review and guide the agencies and their activities. Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who is mayor of South Bend, Indiana, was focusing on agribusiness and merger reform, and also overhauling the Federal Arbitration Act, which the Supreme Court has interpreted as allowing companies to have force claims into arbitration and eliminate class actions. Now, the current administration, in terms of the politics of this, both candidate Trump and President Trump has periodically referred to different antitrust issues. He's tended to hop around from these ideas to other ideas, both during the campaign and during his administration, and obviously spending most of his time holding press briefings about what a good job he's doing on the coronavirus. But he's talked on two things. He's talked about primarily on big tech and on certain media deals. And he's expressed concern about Amazon. He's expressed concern about the owner of Amazon, who also owns the Washington Post. He has criticized the European Commission's fines against US tech companies. And most recently, the economic report of the president in February of 2020 have really just said, stay the course, we don't need any major reforms. And politically, he has expressed a concern about the AT&T Time Warner merger. And that's a direct quote of, I want that deal blocked. And obviously part of that has been related to his dislike of CNN, which is one of the properties of Time Warner. And we can talk more about the administration's failed challenge of that merger after he came into office. The legislation that's pending, and I don't have a very good crystal ball on whether any of these will or will not be enacted. There are bills that relate to the pharmaceutical industry. They basically deal mostly with pay for delay type issues. And there are a lot of bills that would deal with mergers in the agribusiness area. and mergers generally. And the most important pending legislative action isn't actually a bill right now. It is an investigation by the House of Representatives with a very active subcommittee. It's led by Representative David Cicilline, who is from Rhode Island. And there is a House Antitrust Caucus, which is also an interesting political development that didn't exist of a number of members who make this a priority issue. But this investigation in particular is looking at digital markets and potential anti-competitive activity. They have subpoenaed tens of millions of electronic files. The committee is well-staffed, well-resourced. They have held hearings both in DC and around the country. And they have most recently put things on hold during the Corona emergency. However, they have just put out a call and received various expert reports from sort of a bipartisan and wide-ranging group of professors and advocates about what, if anything, they should do. We expect that some call for legislation will emerge out of this investigation, but no report has been issued and is expected for some time. And we expect possibly some coordination between what this House subcommittee is doing and what Elizabeth Warren and others in the Senate are doing. So there might be a joint bill that's introduced in both houses. Whether any of these get passed or not, it's certainly hard to say. It's unlikely if the Senate remains in Republican hands while the House remains in Democratic hands. But obviously a lot turns on the 2020 election. Now, I also like to spend a moment on a draft piece of legislation that is likely to emerge from Senator Warren's office. And I just want to say, to the extent it's relevant, I have been consulted on certain provisions of this and provided feedback to them on different drafts. However, there's no final bill. What did happen is when the next to final version of a bill was circulated among a community of academics, one or more people leaked it to the press, and certain features have been discussed in the public press. And I can talk about those, although, again, I don't know for sure when or if this legislation will be introduced and in what form. But if it does, in the form that was discussed in a couple of articles in the press, it would ban mega mergers above a certain amount that would be in the tens of billions of dollars. It would also create presumptions against mergers above a certain lower threshold. It would bar consideration of efficiencies as a defense. It would put the burden on the defendants to show that there was no harm to competition. And I think most interestingly, this got a little less attention. There's language in there that would prohibit the abuse of market power in language very close to the abuse of dominance test that's used in the EU and many other jurisdictions around the world. It would add the ability of the agencies to impose civil penalties up to 10 or 15%, depending on the offense, akin to what's done outside the United States in many jurisdictions. And it would reverse 30, 40 years of restrictive interpretations of the Supreme Court strengthening various per se offenses and pursuing reviving certain causes of action like the essential facilities doctrine and other things that have been cut back or eliminated. So beyond the legislative, and I'm gonna be getting to the dark side of antitrust in just a couple minutes, this slide just gives you a sense of, I don't want to suggest to you that these books are on the bestseller list. I think several of them should be. However, a bunch of professors, journalists, and industry experts are writing for the general public rather than just fellow law professors or fellow economists or fellow academics. Rich Gilbert's forthcoming book is probably the most technical, along with John Baker's. However, Chris Sagers has a great book about what the US versus Apple case tells us about competition in America. And you have things like The Curse of Business and Goliath and Monopolized and Break 'em Up that suggest that these are all very talented authors searching for a more general audience. So these books are all out or forthcoming shortly, just giving you an idea that there's more talk about antitrust in the public arena than really is typical in the past. This is true with both long form and mass market kind of journalism. There are lots of articles in places like The Atlantic and Harper's Magazine. Lena Khan, who happens to be now on the staff of the House Antitrust Subcommittee, was featured in the New York Times Magazine. And just the other day, a woman, Stacey Mitchell, who's part of an institute for local self-reliance and a big critic of Amazon, is featured on the front page of the New York Times business section. And before the coronavirus hit, when really the campaign and else was really going full steam, there were 33 antitrust-related stories on either the front page of the business of the, or the front page of the business section of the New York Times. That's a story a day, and this just suggests that the journalism market and presumably the readers are paying attention. Most of the stories focus on big tech. Some are on local markets, and obviously even more general and local publications are starting to feature some of these articles. So that's really the descriptive part of my talk. And given that antitrust is more of a political and campaign issue, and given that it's becoming something that we're talking about, at least among business and professional people, just at a level that's new and interesting and kind of exciting for me, what are the downside? What's the dark side of a more political antitrust? And I'm really working my way through this, and I could use your help either in the course of this little discussion or afterwards. I'd welcome your thoughts about how to deal with these kinds of issues. So in the article and even in the summary talk, I hope you understand that my view is that antitrust has always been political, but that there's an increased salience and importance that raises new and longstanding issues. I'm most concerned about when agencies arguably do the right thing for the wrong reason. I'll talk about that in a minute. I'm not particularly concerned about outright corruption. I mean, I'm against it, but we have adequate laws to deal with that. There's certainly been instances of outright corruption. Fortunately, they're few and far between in the United States. One is that a minor part of the Watergate scandal in the Nixon administration was that the Republican Party was getting illegal campaign contributions to influence a pending merger investigation of ITT, at the time a international phone company. In addition, in the Johnson administration, so corruption can be bipartisan as well, Lyndon Johnson, there's taped recordings of Lyndon Johnson threatening a bank in Houston that he would block a merger that they were in the midst of doing if the bank did not pressure the local newspaper to endorse his re-election. So those, I believe, the legal system has ways of ferreting out and dealing with. And nor am I talking about an administration that chooses to not pursue an antitrust investigation because they believe it would be against the broad national interest. I think very few people want a world where we bring an antitrust case by the U.S. government, which creates a major diplomatic incident or potentially, an armed conflict that would just not be in our national interest. From time to time, the president has made such decisions. You can agree or disagree, but I don't think that's corruption, and I don't think that's the misuse of politics. For example, President Truman charged the Justice Department to not criminally prosecute some international oil companies in the late 1940s relating to the Middle East because of the needs of the Cold War and other political considerations. He directed that it be brought as a civil lawsuit on a limited basis against a couple of the American-based firms. And, that could be right or wrong, but I think that's at least a general elevation of the national interest in a broader sense than just whether there was or was not a technical antitrust violation. So what am I talking about? Well, my hypothetical, and it might not be hypothetical depending on what happens down the road in either what remains of the Trump administration or any administration afterwards. What if one or both of the agencies in the United States or somewhere else sue Amazon for a case that is plausible, but because of a political animus or bias against Jeff Bezos or the positions that his other company, the Washington Post, take? Similarly, hypothetically, what if you refrain from the plausible but perhaps legally risky merger challenge to help a political ally. Conceivably, the EU challenges to abusive dominance in the tech sector against mostly US firms could be the same kind of situation. And the closest we have in real life is the AT&T Time Warner case, where there was some press, and it's impossible to know what the actual answer is. There's some press that there were communications from the White House to the Department of Justice to look into this or to bring a case. And a case was brought. It was not a frivolous case, but it was ultimately not a winner for the Department of Justice. The defendants sought to get discovery under our system about whether there were or were not communications or pressure to bring the case. The judge denied this as not being legally relevant to whether the merger did or did not raise a serious issue of harm to competition down the road. So this is a broader conversation. I'm fascinated by whether this gives us, whether we have the tools in the United States and whether the judgments about whether you're doing the right thing for the wrong reason should turn on whether there is probable cause or a good legal basis for what you're doing. And there are many areas of the law where that is true. That's the main standard. For example, malicious prosecution. If someone sues or brings a criminal case without probable cause, the person who's injured may be able to bring a later tort case against that. However, there are other areas of the law, and I'll give you just one example, where it's not just whether the case has some arguable merit, but sometimes the courts look to see what was the motivation. So actually, I'll give you two short examples, and then I'll throw this open for conversation and questions. We also have a tort called abuse of process, where you may have sued somebody for something that has some merit, but you were really doing it for an improper purpose, to perhaps embarrass them or humiliate them or run up their legal fees or use a minor piece of litigation to discover their trade secrets improperly or something like that. And what's interesting is in civil litigation in the United States, we use both of these standards. Under our rules of civil procedure, a plaintiff and the lawyers can be sanctioned if they either bring a case that lacks legal or factual merit, or if they bring it for an improper purpose. So we have some tools. They've been rarely applied in the antitrust setting, but I think you're gonna see more discussion of whether something else is needed. And we currently do not have good tools legally to deal with an agency exercising its discretion not to bring a plausible case against someone, perhaps to help them because they're viewed as a political ally. So Pablo, I'm gonna stop there. I apologize for talking a little longer than I meant to, and I hope we can have a nice discussion about any and all of these issues that I've raised.
Thank you very, very much, Spencer, as usual. We do have some questions here. Let me read one, and then I try to give the microphone to some of the questions we have here. Marianela López Galdós, she's from Spain and she lives in Washington. She asked the following question. House Representative Sicilin announced today he intends to include an antitrust provision in the next stimulus package to ban all mergers except for the ones that would fall under the falling firm defense. Do you have an opinion on such announcement?
I had been preparing for my talk this morning, so I hadn't had a chance to see the news, so thank you. That's a lot to process. My reaction is there are many mergers that are simply harmless from a competitive point of view, so I'm very sympathetic for reforming our merger laws. I'm not sure I'd go quite that far. And I'm more concerned actually about the other side. I'm more concerned that the current crisis we're in, both health and economic, will be an excuse to jam through mergers that have hints of failing firm, but don't really qualify under the normal standards. I mean, we've seen that back in 2008. So I think that's a real risk. I'd have to see the proposal to really have any further comment.
Okay. Juan David Gutierrez. Well, the question of Juan David is also here. It's, are trajectories of political antitrust in other jurisdictions different or similar than that in the US?
I don't know enough. I mean, the EU Commission's policies are not directly affected by elections, but they're indirectly affected by the composition of the Commission and the obviously the Commissioner for Competition. So, I mean, they're not affected at the EU level by politics in the sense of campaign politics at the same level they are in the United States. And again, I saw another comment from somebody on the chat that, you know, this is not just an issue of technical antitrust law, but a matter of competition policy. So, you know, I would imagine in many jurisdictions, there is certainly discussion of the broader implications of corporate concentration, abuse of corporate power, income inequality, the relationship of that and market structure. I think those issues are fairly broadly and well discussed around the world and outside the United States, but I don't follow enough of the specific jurisdictions to be able to comment, and I think the people on this call can talk about those better than I can.
There's a question from Agustin Ciboldi from Buenos Aires. He says he has the impression that in countries as Argentina, for example, our politicians have not real knowledge of the antitrust tools in order to gain competitiveness in our economies. I'm reading. We repeatedly come across not only business-originated restrictions, but distortions to competition coming from the regulation, which are both neglected by the authorities. And here is the question. How do you think private enforcement would help in this context?
Well, I think there's two things. Pablo, you and I have spoken at and organized conferences that deal with the growth of private enforcement in Latin America. And there are certainly movements in that direction. Most of you know that in the United States, something like 90 to 95% of the total number of cases are private litigation. They're mostly for damages, and they rarely affect large mergers or issues of deconcentration or of restructuring. So private enforcement can help, but it can only go so far. And I was going to say, in addition to private enforcement, there's the issue of that culture of competition. I refer to it as what's going on in civil society. I think the more institutes like the IDC, the more you have academic programs and institutes like our Institute for Consumer Antitrust Studies, the more conferences there are, the more experts there are who can reach out to the press. And again, I'm not talking about the front page of just a general newspaper, but whatever are the magazines that cover business and politics and economics and public policy, the more you can get that conversation going, the more politicians will respond to it, and I think the better informed they are. So I think it's great, and my paper talks about this a little bit. There are a tremendous number of, some of them are lobbying organizations, some of them are more policy organizations, that have a bunch of really smart people who are there to talk about competition policy, broader competition policy, not just technical rules of antitrust. And they're able to write op-eds. They're able to lobby and informally talk to politicians and provide them input on bills and get into what's smart and not smart and tee up issues. I really don't think that there'd be much of a conversation in the United States about whether or not our antitrust laws should be amended to include the abuse of dominance or something similar if it weren't for people in the just outside of politics pushing on these kinds of issues. So I would say, from what I know about a handful of jurisdictions in Latin America, the more you can create master's programs, the more you can create student societies, the more you can create professional societies, the more you have bar associations and academic groups that focus on this, the more these issues will begin to bubble up and inform the broader conversation, you know, in the public and with and in the political sector.
Thank you, Spencer. We have a question from Ian Forrester. Ian, do you want me to unmute?
Sure. Greetings. This is such an intriguing format. I don't know how many continents we're all from, but 60 people talking about a common subject of perpetual interest is great. It's really interesting. What I was going to say, commenting on the last but one intervention, it's often said that there's a policy skew against American companies on the part of DG Competition, that it's shocking that the targets are Google and Intel and Microsoft. I don't think there is such a policy skew. I think that it's the case that Brussels is a more attractive place to make radical new antitrust argument, more attractive, more welcoming to novel theories than is the case in a U.S. district court in California, where a conservative judge is going to hear with a certain skepticism, and I'm all for skeptical judges, the arguments made, and where perhaps a jury has to be convinced as well. Not criticizing juries, to the contrary, I'm rather impressed by the ones I've seen at work. But it's possible to bring a completely novel theory, which hitherto has been largely confined to antitrust gurus, lovies, enthusiasts, and see the European Commission run with it. So if you want to make a radical argument, Brussels is a good place to come and make your complaint.
I think that's great. I mean, I agree, and I just put that in there because, I'm interested in how you deal with an issue where you have a perfectly plausible case, and in addition, there's some other factor going on. That's all I meant by including it in that slide. I actually personally think that the world has harmonized around a EU general standard relating to abuse of dominance, and the US is the outlier. And for all the talk by our government of the need to harmonize, I agree, but I think the harmonization, the world has spoken, if there's a market for antitrust, we've coalesced on a standard, and the US needs to kind of have a more productive relationship with the rest of the world on abusive, single firm abuse type concepts. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think there's some administrative law aspects to that, in the way that a complaint in the EU has legal significance, and that the Commission has a lot of discretion. But whatever it decides to do, that's an official decision that theoretically has to be supported by reasoned decision and can be challenged by affected parties. I personally would love to have a system like that, and that would be one way to deal with the misuse of discretion not to bring a case. If the agencies in the US, they sometimes say why they didn't bring a case, but they're not under an obligation to. And there's essentially no one who can challenge a decision in the US not to go forward as a matter of prosecutorial discretion. I've been accused of being un-American for saying that in various articles.
Thank you both. There's also another question from Makis Kaminos. I understand Makis is in Russia or in Greece. Makis, you want to make your question?
Yes, hi, very fascinating. I mean, one question which is interesting for us in Europe, at least, is the role of the judiciary in the US. I mean, you have a certain Supreme Court currently, and we know what the case of the main antitrust courts is like in the US. Can you explain a bit how the US judiciary interacts with all these ideas? I mean, could it be a break on extremist agendas, for example, on antitrust? Or can Congress supersede the Supreme Court, for example? Can the Supreme Court allege a constitutional kind of issue? So I'm quite interested in this area. Can this agenda progress? Can this progressive agenda go through irrespective of the Supreme Court and the courts in the U.S.?
Okay, I was having a little trouble hearing you, but if I gather you were asking about what is the role of the judiciary, particularly the Supreme Court, and how does that relate to actual or proposals for legislation? Is that more or less? So it's a very fair and very important question. Our agencies, by and large, have to go to federal court to win a case. They can bring a case and then they have to win it. And a criminal case for hardcore cartel, that would normally be proving a case that the defendant's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And that would normally have a jury in our criminal system. In a civil case, it would depend on exactly what they're suing for, but it would either be decided by the judge or possibly decided by the jury. So the big decision for most cases is whether the agency brings a case and can win it in court. So as Judge Forster, I think, was mentioning, and others, a lot depends on who the judge is. I mean, I'm not saying it's a corrupt decision, but I mean, the judge's basic background is pretty important. And most judges in federal court in the United States have little or no antitrust experience. It is extremely unusual for a trial level judge to have worked for the FTC or the antitrust division, or even a large firm where that person did a lot of antitrust. Most federal judges tend to be, this has nothing to do with antitrust one way or another, they just tend to be former federal prosecutors, sometimes state court judges, and then sometimes private lawyers who have some relationship with a United States senator who has pushed their nomination. So we have no lifetime judicial track like is the case in most civil law jurisdictions. So you have judges who are generally older and have a great deal of experience, but probably never seen an antitrust case before, and have whatever political and philosophical leanings they have just on who they are in real life and which administration appointed them. So the judiciary is becoming increasingly conservative, given that President Trump has been able to appoint judges. Judges have to be confirmed by the United States Senate, which is a Republican majority at the moment. So that is a serious concern, that a judge who is smart, not corrupt, but has never really seen most of these cases before, is going to rely on standard thinking, perhaps some training that they receive from a conservative law and economics type group. They're going to do the safe thing. They're not going to do anything edgy. They're going to be concerned that they'll be overturned, and that all defendants have a right to automatically appeal to our courts of appeal. But the Supreme Court has virtually unlimited discretion in what cases it's going to hear. Supreme Court hears, on average, about 75 or 80 cases a year. They receive 4,000 to 5,000 petitions of all kinds of cases, criminal, civil, constitutional. There is a Republican majority on the Supreme Court. They tend to vote conservatively on antitrust cases. They tend to adopt, in my view, fairly simplistic views of older law and economic theories that I don't think reflect current economic conditions, and I don't think we're necessarily right in the first place always. So the Supreme Court's a hard sell for a novel case, and just what Judge Forster was talking about, where the European Commission and the European courts and the member state courts may be more receptive to certain theories. The reflexive view of our Supreme Court is when they take a case, it is generally to restrict rather than expand antitrust theories. So you're not gonna get a lot of change on the Supreme Court until, they talk about, what's the phrase? Personnel is policy. So, you're not gonna argue someone on the Supreme Court who has well-formed views about one way of looking at antitrust, you're not gonna convince them to change their lifetime position on this. So it really matters the next few appointments as to how that's going to go. Now, unless the Supreme Court rules that some aspect of antitrust is required or forbidden by the Constitution, Congress can more or less pass any bill they want, changing it. And there have been bills from time to time that have overturned a particular Supreme Court decision in different areas, sometimes regulatory decisions, sometimes just things that Congress is annoyed about. So it happens. It doesn't happen very often on antitrust issues because until recently, it's hard to get Congress's attention and get it through both houses of Congress to overturn a decision that looks kind of technical and reasonable people can differ, and nobody in Congress pays enough attention to know what the right answer is. So I'll give you an example. In around 2007, the United States Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, changed the law on resale price maintenance, on vertical price fixing. It had been per se unreasonable. From that decision forward, it became on a rule, case-by-case rule of reason basis. And there have been no important decisions or cases won on that theory since that time. Congress had several bills to overturn that. And there was one senator in particular who pushed this. He happened to be from Wisconsin. His name is Herbert Cole, and his family, although I don't think he, but his family ran a discount department store that depended very heavily on the ability to conduct deep discounts on clothes and household goods. So he was very familiar with that issue. He pushed and pushed and pushed, and he got some support, but it never got enacted because, to be honest, Congress has more important things than, you know, doing something in some small area. So I would think that if there's going to be significant change, you either have to change the composition of the federal judiciary, or you have to change the composition of both houses of Congress so that a reform package can go through that broadly changes the parameters of U.S. antitrust rather than focuses on changing a particular decision that, you know, that you think might be wrong.
Can I ask a question? If you look at the cases which have been chosen by the Supreme Court or argument, is there any pattern? They don't do it often, and each step is quite an event for the antitrust bar. Can you make any conclusion from the pattern of the cases that they select?
It was really difficult. So when either the government or private party wants the Supreme Court to review a case, they have to petition the court. Mm-hmm. And 4 of the 9 justices have to vote to hear the case. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. Now, the procedure, and this is for all cases, it's not just for antitrust. As far as I know, all the justices, except maybe one, delegate the initial review of all these petitions to hear a case. They're called cert petitions, C-E-R-T, for the Latin word certiorari. So they just, each week, one justice delegates to one of his or her law clerks to review however many came in that week and recommend to the entire group of justices which ones look potentially good to hear. And they're never going to take more than 2 or 3 at most antitrust cases because they have other, you know, important things to decide, issues of constitution, other statutes, and some private law cases where the lower courts just disagree with each other. So it's pretty rare. And because, you know, each justice contributes one law clerk to do the weekly review of these things, it's very hard to see if there's a pattern. Justice Powell was probably one of the last justices who had a real agenda of what he wanted to achieve in the antitrust area. He wanted to get rid of per se rules for different reasons. So he was on the lookout for cases. Justice Stevens, because he was the last Supreme Court justice to be a litigating antitrust lawyer before he became a judge, was probably the last one who just thought they were like interesting and wanted to decide important cases because he liked them. So a pattern's hard to emerge. What I've seen, the only pattern I can see over the last 10, 15 years is that the court does seem to be interested in restricting private enforcement in a couple ways. There's been a pattern of cases tightening the requirements for class actions. And that's very ironic, given that the rest of the world is figuring out how important these are to aggregate small claims, where nobody in their right mind would bring a case for $20, $200, or $2,000. So our Supreme Court is restricting class rules while many jurisdictions are trying to figure out what's a good way to do that. The other thing I see them doing is they have been enforcing arbitration clauses in contracts with between corporations and consumers that effectively get rid of antitrust litigation because they forbid bringing a case or bringing a class action. And again, most people don't have the resources or the interest in pursuing small value claims in arbitration. So I've seen them in recent years restrict class actions, promote arbitration, and to some extent, every once in a while, continue to chip away at the remaining per se rules or presumptions of liability.
So you're saying it's the functioning of the justice system rather than the technicalities of intriguing antitrust theories, which that those questions have better chance of being picked.
It's really what bubbles up to even get to the stage where the Supreme Court can hear can review a petition to hear a particular case, because it means that somebody brought a case on a theory. Usually a plaintiff, a government brings a few cases now and then. It means that they have lost. It means that they have appealed two stages, and it means that the decision of the Court of Appeals is sufficiently, that the Supreme Court thinks that whatever that decision is sufficiently out of the mainstream to get their attention. So usually the cases that the Supreme Court has to pick from in antitrust is when a plaintiff gets lucky, wins a case, whether or not they deserve to, that's on some older theory that the Supreme Court doesn't like and just hasn't had a chance to look at. So it's a little bit luck of the draw. It's been a while since the U.S. government has brought a case and has fought it all the way to the Supreme Court and gotten a good result. It happens. I don't remember, around 2013, the FTC pushed all the way to the Supreme Court with respect to pay for delay and reverse settlement agreements in the pharmaceutical industry, and it won.
Yes.
It was five to four. It could have destroyed enforcement in that area, but they did a great job. And as a result, those cases now can be brought by the government and by private parties under a rule of reason with some presumptions. And there's been fairly vigorous enforcement. So I give them credit for that. And that's become kind of a nonpartisan pro-enforcement position for administrations, Republican and Democrat, to bring. But that's fairly rare. What I've seen more is the Supreme Court, its antenna goes up when it sees sort of what it thinks is an undeserved victory by a plaintiff.
Pablo, hi, Simon Holmes here. Taking my cue from, Spencer, Pablo, giving me the floor. Two questions, if I may. One simple one, and one which I think I find difficult. The simple one, which I put on the chat, was there was a proposal recently, I think it was in the Stigler report, but I'm not certain, that the US should have a court with specialist judges, perhaps a bit like we have here in the UK with the Competition Appeal Tribunal. So my narrower question is, do you think that's ever going to see the light of the day? And perhaps you want to comment on that now. Then I'll give you my other question.
Without getting into whether it's a good idea or not, I think it's highly unlikely. It's been proposed by both progressive and conservative critics of the current system. Most of the cases that the judges get, just by number and by the amount of dollars, are class actions that relate to price-fixing cases. So a generalist judge, the law isn't that hard. You know, if you can prove that it happened and you can prove causation and you can create a reasonable estimate of the damages and satisfy the class action rules, you win or usually the case is settled. So I think your average judge knows how to handle a case like that? And there are just not that many cases being brought because the agencies on a bipartisan basis are relatively conservative in how far they want to push new theories, for many of the reasons that Judge Forster was talking about. That, you know, yeah, they come up, particularly in the handful of merger cases that go to litigation, that's usually pretty new for the judge. It would be great if they had some expertise, but these cases are usually well litigated. They're usually a lot of amicus briefs on both sides that are being filed. So I think they can handle them okay. We don't have a great tradition of specialist judges at the federal level. We have a court of international trade that does mostly customs disputes. We have a tax court and a bankruptcy court are the three biggest specialty courts we have. So given the volume of, let's say, the difference between tax and bankruptcy cases and antitrust, I think it's unlikely that we're going to get that. I'll leave it to other people whether they think it's a good idea or not.
Yeah. Okay. No, fair enough. So I thought that would be the answer. I hadn't seen much momentum behind it. But my second question has been discussed a little bit in the discussion since I put the question, and I put it in the context of the thought that I'd had of trying to brief the Elizabeth Warren team in relation to antitrust not standing in the way of important action for businesses to cooperate to fight climate change. Now, I wasn't trying to switch this into the sustainability agenda, which was the subject of, I think, of our last meeting of the IDC. But it's an example of how do you get progressive issues onto the agenda. I've been asking myself this question and planning to produce a sort of briefing for journalists and politicians, prompted by the fact that one of my neighbours has been appointed as the deputy opposition minister for competition and climate change, our ministry, the Bayes ministry here. And I think it's an uphill struggle. Is it worth trying to go into the Elizabeth Warren camp or in perhaps now the Biden camp? Or are we better to keep working through the established bodies like the IDC, like the Inclusive Competition Forum, which we have here, taking things as I have done to the ICC, to the OECD, and let's talk about taking some of these issues to the United Nations and to WTO, and through them getting it into the political agenda. Have you any thoughts on the viability of getting it directly into the political discourse?
You're right, it is a difficult issue. And for whatever reason, that link between competition and sustainability, environmental, climate change, however you want to phrase it, has been more front and center in the EU and in the UK than it has in the United States. And, you know, obviously your work and others, and I've seen a lot of both technical and kind of policy work about when cooperation in the area can and should be deemed lawful. For some whatever reason, that hasn't come up yet as a big issue in the United States. My short answer to you is all the above. In my limited experience, these kinds of issues do not usually come from the top down, they come from the bottom up.
Yeah.
So the more academic writings, the more policy briefings, the more reports like Stigler, like the Furman report, you know, that's the reason why these issues, big tech has some political salience, because lots of different commentators are bubbling up and the candidates and the campaigns and the congressional staffs, they know about this stuff, you know. Yeah. I would work through Warren's Senate staff. I would work through the House Antitrust Committee. I would work through the campaigns. My guess is the campaigns are going to be pivoting on issues of corona, and that the economic policy stuff will be phrased as matters of inequality and social safety net. But what you're talking about is important, and I can't predict whether it will make a debate stage, in the fall campaign in the United States. But it looks like, to me, the broadest look at all these issues is Cicilline's antitrust probe, and his staff is already geared up to think about these issues, and there's no reason why it's not specifically an Amazon, Microsoft, Facebook, you know, Amazon kind of thing. But there's no reason why that wouldn't be a one of many avenues to pursue.
And the corona is an obvious hook, and that's the latest one that I've been writing about.
Of course. And, you know, in the United States, there is an antitrust exemption already that allows pharma companies to cooperate to ensure an adequate supply of the annual flu vaccine. It would not surprise me at all if that is expanded to very deliberately include corona testing and eventual vaccines and treatments.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Simon. Thanks, Spencer. We have a question by Bob Banafe-Havus. I'm going to give the room to him.
Hi, Bob.
Perfect. All right. Thank you very much, Spencer, for the opportunity. A fantastic talk as usual. I've just got a quick question. You made the comment about, the current state of competition law in the US, you know, the Chicago Law School, how that had impacted on what at the time was a developing sense of competition culture in the United States, right? Now, apart from that, I mean, the Chicago Law School, yes, it still has some pervasive effects in the position of the Supreme Court in terms of their jurisprudence. But I'm wondering, apart from that, if you can possibly speculate on what might be behind the current cultural lag in terms of, you know, the current reality of anti-competitive practices in the US, like big companies. You know, yes, there seems to be this bubbling up kind of a discussion. You highlighted a couple of books that have been written in terms of competition, but compared to earlier competition law historical discourses in the US, there seems to be some difference. I wonder what if you could possibly speculate on what might be behind this sense of a cultural lag, you know, in the US in terms of that vibrant competition cultural discourse that used to exist in previous times.
Well, I think a lot of it is it's just a time lag of cultural and economic and legal thinking. I think the Supreme Court is usually older, more experienced justices whose views are formed at an earlier stage, and they stay with them, whether you agree with them or not, or whether it's progressive or more conservative. So, I think this generation of Supreme Court justices had their views formed 30, 40 years ago on many of these issues, and sometimes they're willing to put in the hard work, but just human psychology is, you know, if you have a well thought out view of something, it takes a lot to sort of push you to a new way of thinking. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just human nature. So I think the things that were novel in the 1970s and 1980s about how to look at the relationship of law and economics is kind of old news right now, but the new news hasn't gotten through to the Supreme Court, and that will change over time, hopefully. Now, in civil society, I don't know. It's weird. I don't know why certain issues gain the attention of the business press, in the sort of the policy magazines or not. So when the story about the draft legislation on from Elizabeth Warren's Senate office, when that got leaked to the press, once it's out there, everybody sort of gloms onto it. So whoever ran it first was immediately followed by, 12 or 14 other newspapers either running the same item through it, like a news service, or assigning a person to try and figure out what's going on. Because whenever it happened, it leaked overnight, and I woke up the next morning and I had 12 requests for a comment, because my name was on one of the emails that ended up getting leaked. And then two requests from different producers of Fox News to go on the air and talk about it. So, I mean, it's just sort of a herd effect. And is antitrust trendy? In the broader sense, not the technical legal rules. It's trendy because I think coming out of the financial recession of 2008, people began to think differently about concentrated markets. The 99% and the 1% wasn't specifically about antitrust, but it was about economic concentration, and that got people thinking. And I think the media and follow trends, and then those trends bubble up in different ways that show up in legislation and other things. And people study it in schools and write about it, everything from law review articles with 500 footnotes to op-eds, you know, and at some point, a more political or electoral person can glom onto that because they think there's something in it for them, and that's fine. by and large, people running for high office don't model their campaigns on obscure, unimportant things that nobody cares about. So I don't know exactly how you get to that threshold, but when you get to that threshold, suddenly people begin to pay attention in all kinds of interesting ways.
Right. If I could just ask a follow-up question then, do you think there might be work for a bit of advocacy to get, you know, that, you know, getting that threshold a bit earlier? So for example, because like we all know the competition reality in the US, you know, there has been this sort of hijack law, articles have been written on the point, Facebook, there's the call that Facebook should be broken up. So I'm wondering what you think could be done to fast track that process of getting to the threshold that would then, you know, spot this vibrancy again.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the people on this call are in a unique position in all their different jurisdictions to do these kinds of things. I think people at the agencies can do competition advocacy to plant the groundwork for what you call the culture of competition, which is right, particularly in newer and developing jurisdictions where notions of business competition just haven't sunk in, or maybe contrary to sort of just general ways of business and family relationships. So I think the agencies can do things, and I know they do. I think they should continue that. And I think for newer agencies, that might be a terrific, very cost-effective type of long-term strategy rather than pinning their hopes on coming out of the gate with a gigantic case to break up Facebook in some jurisdiction, you know, something like that. But I think, you know, I think it's on us to sort of explain, just to shout in as many different ways as we can why this stuff is important and why it matters, right? It's not, you know, it's hard to explain to somebody what resale price maintenance is. It's really easy to explain to them why clothes never go on sale of a particular manufacturer. So, you know, it's just getting out there in a way that makes sense. And I do think it all bubbles up eventually. But again, we're competing for people's time and attention with a million other news things, as well as video games, work, family, comic books, you know, and everything.
Thanks, Morgan. Thanks, Spencer. Let me try to give the floor again to South America for a minute. We have a question from George.
Hi, Spencer. Very nice.
How are you?
Not too bad. Thank you for your talk. Always very interesting. Let me bring you back to the Latin American reality a little bit. I think there is a kind of fair consensus here, a broad consensus that politically antitrust is not important in our countries, generally speaking. This is either because probably we have a system that is much more created as an European system, in the sense that we rely a lot on public sanctions and public litigation rather than private ones, as in the US. But we don't have an objective, a straight objective, a clear objective for antitrust, as let's say creating a common market as it was in Europe at some point. On the other hand, we don't have many cases in many countries, and in countries where there are cases, we're much more focused on collusion cases rather than unilaterals, which are probably the most important things, problems that we have in markets in our countries. So my question is basically, how do we boost the political importance of antitrust, putting a straight objective there and saying antitrust matters because this is and that, and this is what we're going to achieve if we have a more important antitrust law or antitrust policy, or through cases, if we, instead of relying on collective conduct cases, or we put the emphasis on unilateral conduct cases. What do you think? Or maybe there is another alternative. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. You know, what I know about Chile, I think they've done a good job. I think Fiscalía has picked a number of cases that I think speak to people's pocketbooks. You have the pharmacy case, you have the toilet paper case, you have the poultry case. And you have others that I think you can sell to. I think you can sell to the public, particularly if they're not used to thinking of antitrust as a consumer issue. I think those kinds of cases make perfect sense. They all of those happen to be collusion cases. You know, in the United States, it's really hard to get people excited about mergers in intermediate markets for some chemical that's used to manufacture something. But you know, it's not that hard to get somebody, at least get some press attention when you bring a case involving bid rigging about something, maybe for road construction or some consumer good or the school system that, you know, that's buying furniture or school buses or something like that, where the price tag goes up and the taxes go up as a result of the collusion. So I think picking smart cases that have some public resonance is really a good step. But I agree with you. I think the U.S. has made a mistake to say that cartels are public enemy number one, but then not have a public enemy number two to go with it for antitrust purposes. So I would, if there's the right unilateral conduct case that makes sense from consumers and you can explain to them why it's either theft or why their fees or their taxes are going up or why their choice is going down and why it's a ripoff in the same way that false advertising or actual fraud is a ripoff, then I think that would be helpful. And I think, you know, the growth of private rights of action will help because people will see that how it affects their own pocketbook, and to the extent that they're losing money, that they have some way of getting redress. It's important. And I don't follow the Fiscalía on a day-to-day basis, but you know, what they say and how they do their press relations and briefings and articles and op-eds and teaching and conferences, I think is as important as the case selection. So I don't think it's any one thing, but you're right. If the agency is just going about their business, bringing cases, and that's about it, that's not a way to make it important to the people that they're serving.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Spencer and Javier. Following Javier in Chile, we have also Manuela Barca from Chile, who has also another question for you.
Regarding the Javier's question, one of the main issues in the Latin American antitrust scene, in my opinion, is consisting there is a lack of enforcement of unilateral conduct. Mostly cases in Latin America are only cartels, especially hardcore cartels, but we haven't seen many cases of abuses of dominant position. Moreover, there is a general idea, especially in academic, that exploitative conduct, especially excessive pricing, should not be prosecuted even. Situation. Basically, we all agree that price fixing is bad, but unilateral conduct are mostly good. Is this situation related to like a political or ideological option of intentionally not prosecute this kind of conduct, or it's more like a technical issue? For example, in our market, we can see that we don't see many firms with market power. There is more efficiency than risk, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. This is similar to what we were talking about with Judge Tapia as well. I think it's both. I think an agency that has limited resources would not be well served if it just spent all its time and money and people on, you know, one big gigantic unilateral conduct case. However, I do think agencies around the world have been sold a little bit of a bill of goods by some of their US counterparts, particularly over the last 30 years. There's been a lot of technical assistance where the message has been cartels, cartels, cartels. And I think the world has changed, and I think that's fine. I think those cases are incredibly important, and in some ways they're the great training ground for an agency to develop its own muscles and you know, create a track record of good results. But they can't be the only thing that it does. I completely agree with you. I'd like to see a world where there's a better balance in the United States as well as in other jurisdictions about these kinds of cases. I do know that, you know, at least historically in some Latin American countries, a little bit in Chile if you go back a long way, and a little bit in Peru if you go back like 30 years, they were bringing not very sophisticated unilateral conduct cases. And I think it hurt the credibility of the agency in some ways. So, you know, there's risks on both sides. And, you know, I don't, I don't know what the US is going to end up doing. We have all kinds of federal and state investigations of the big tech companies. We have no idea at this point what cases will emerge. And I think there's at least some plausible claims that should be explored that could also be a way of reinvigorating some legal theories. I would urge all jurisdictions not to follow too closely the United States' restrictive view of what is and isn't unlawful unilateral conduct. In most jurisdictions, you have the abuse of dominance concept, so there's a natural reason to look to the law of the EU. But if there's an issue that has not been well thought out or dealt with in your jurisdiction, I would urge you to look carefully at other countries that have covered these things and compare what makes sense and what is permissible or required under each jurisdiction's law and enforcement policy, and really look for best practices around the world. And as I was talking with Judge Forrester, I think there's a consensus on what are the legitimate violations that fall under the abuse of dominance, and they typically go beyond what the United States courts have recognized as illegal Section 2 type behavior.
Yeah, just one question, maybe two. One from Warsaw that's been waiting for a while, Maciej Bernat. You can use the room, please.
So I have a question concerning the situation when the agency is setting priorities, because I think that this might be related to your question you are asking yourself about political kind of background of the situation. In my research, I observe a problem in Central Europe that we rather have politically driven inaction rather than action, and you somehow touch up on this. At the same time, in the EU, there is this policy that agencies should have a right to set priorities. And I wonder what's your view on that, in a sense that potentially I see a clash between the two, because the right to set priorities might be a way of not bringing that are politically sensitive. I don't know if this is an issue in the US, but that's basic.
No, it's a very important issue, and you and I have talked about this a little bit before, and I've really learned a lot from your work on whether or not the agencies are allowing state-owned enterprise to merge or do other things that might otherwise be a violation. So it's a really important issue. I just don't know how you get around prosecutorial discretion. It's inherent in our system, and it's still part of the more structured EU Commission and national competition authorities that you work with on a daily basis. So I don't have a clear answer. I do know that if you go back 10, 20 years, particularly for the agencies that do both competition and consumer cases, if you eliminate all discretion, you end up with an equally bad situation where the agency spends way too much time and money working its way through essentially mandatory small, false advertising and little kind of consumer issues, and never gets around to or never has the resources to do the bigger, longer, more complicated competition cases. So I don't know what to say other than it's a balance, but I do believe that the issue of agency discretion is the ultimate issue of administrative law. And I don't think, I've never seen a really thorough solution for that. I'd welcome any suggestions from anybody who's on the call or listening to the recording. Happy to have an exchange via email or otherwise about ways of dealing with that. But I think you're absolutely right. That's probably the most important issue we have to grapple with.
Yes, thanks.
Well, Spencer, thank you very, very much for your contribution, for this excellent panel. Unfortunately, we have a lot of questions, but we need to wrap up and finish because you have to leave, we all have to leave, but I think it's a very interesting issue to keep discussing, and mainly in this year in the US also, considering your elections and everything will be again on the table.
Well, thank you to everybody. I look forward to staying in touch, and you're welcome to email me at my university, at Loyola University Chicago, and I look forward to staying in touch on all these issues. Thank you so much, Pablo, for having me.
Thank you very much,
Spencer. Really good.
Everybody, and see you again in the future.
Very good.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.